My intention is to look at two essays very quickly of James Baldwin out of his book called The Fire Next Time, and then look more carefully at some literary characters in Toni Morrison's book, The Song of Solomon. Look at the character of Pilate, who's the main character, and I'll explain to you who she is. And then some characters in Alice Walker's The Color Purple. And to talk about, Verlon said, what are you doing today? This is Verlon right here, walking out. asked what I was doing. I said, we're covering Baldwin, Morrison, and Walker. You can't cover Baldwin, Morrison, and Walker in 1 hour. So the focus that I thought I would use is how all black writers integrate the concept of freedom and love. And without freedom, in its most complex understanding of freedom, in our most complex understanding of freedom, we can't understand what love is. And we can't even act out love, let alone understand it. So, howdy. So that'll be our general approach. James Baldwin says in The Fire Next Time, which is something we have in our library here. I think we have it in the bookstore too. And it's a real, there are two, one's a letter, they're both in the form of letters, but two real powerful essays on, including his insights about the about American culture and American society, and really about white guilt. And that's, so it's really written for white people as well as black, I think. Anyway, in The Fire Next Time, Baldwin says, my country and my countrymen, and written in 1961, he means women too. My country and my countrymen are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not know it, and do not want to know it. And in my own notes of that, I underlined that, do not want to know it. I'll tell you two facts that we don't want to know, or two illustrations of how much we want to resist, or don't care about things, don't want to know about things that are ugly to us. 3 years ago, I was in South Africa, and I met a white woman who was a grandmother. She was 57 years old, had lived in Johannesburg all her life, and she was working for World Vision and was what we would call, I suppose, a liberal, and just really thought she believed in equal rights in South Africa and so on. And she said, you know, I just saw, she was 57 years old, she said, I just saw the movie Cry Freedom. Has anybody seen that? Good. If you haven't, that might be something that you'd enjoy. You can check it out or get it at any, right here at Holden, at any, you know, what, Blockbuster or anything like that. There's one right up the street here. she had just seen the movie Cry Freedom, which is about the oppression of blacks, to generalize it. And she's driving the car down the freeway and she said, you know, I had no idea. I had no idea. I've lived here all my life. And the point is clear, isn't it? She's lived in Johannesburg all her life and had no idea, even though the white people are 11% of the population in South Africa, she still had no idea about the oppression of blacks in South Africa. Part of that is the censorship of the media there, but another part of it is Baldwin said, we don't want to know. Another thing that I learned at Holden Village 2 years ago, there's only one budget bigger in the whole country than what California spends on its penal institutions. Guess what it is? Defense. No budget bigger in the whole country than what, I mean, first, the biggest budget in the country is national defense, and the second biggest budget in the country is California's penal system. That's a mind-boggling thing. The guy that presented this over a two-week period was the chaplain of Charles Manson, and his titles of all of his sessions were called The Crime of Punishment. A little twist on Dostoevsky's novel. But we don't want to know that either, do we? And my point in bringing up those two examples is only to say that we like to just push stuff aside, that, you know, put those criminals in jail, let's not deal with them. Let somebody else do that, and we'll spend a whole lot of money to do that. And this woman in South Africa will take a whole lot of effort to just kind of ignore what's going on right around her. And I had asked her if she'd ever been in a black township, and her answer, 57 years, no. I don't know how you avoid that. Well, Baldwin goes on in his book here and says, white people are, in effect, still trapped in a history which they do not understand. And until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. And that's part of this idea. I said our focus is going to be on love and freedom. And by freedom, I don't just mean from slavery, as we had in a session last time, but freedom and try to understand that and all the things that control us. And we can be shackled in other ways than, of course, or we can be enslaved in other ways than shackles around our wrists or ankles. We're all trapped and we don't know it, says Baldwin. I'd like to give you an illustration of that, too. When I was at the University of Oregon, because we're on the West Coast, I guess, and we had a lot of Asian students, we had annually an Asian Celebration Day. And on that day, there were Asian flags up in the different buildings, and in the cafeterias served Asian food. And I remember walking through the line that day, I said, boy, this is going to be good. And I saw these strawberries and pineapple and all this grapefruit, and I heaped it on my plate, and then I got to the main staple, and it was poi. Has anybody ever eaten poi? Did you like it? No. I mean, it's as I remember, this was kind of like gray mud. And I'm cool. Take this poi that I sat up there. I ate my fruit and went across to McDonald's and got a hamburger afterwards. What strikes me about that, and listen to Baldwin again. White people are, I would argue we all are, and he does too. But in this sentence he says, white people are in effect still trapped in a history which they do not understand, and until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. That's why I tell you the story about the Asian days at Oregon, even our taste buds are entrapped by a sense of history. I didn't choose to like hamburgers over poi. And in fact, if this same body had been born in another place, obviously, right, poi would be cool and I wouldn't have had to go over to get the hamburger to get the finished dinner. So even these taste buds on the end of our tongue somehow get shaped and we're trapped in something. And the more we begin to realize all of these forces that trap us, the more we can begin to step out in freedom. That's Baldwin's argument. Within this history, that's one of the factors that we need to understand to become free. We hold on to a lot of things that I think legitimize us, that legitimize our behavior, that legitimize our values. And can anybody think of things that we hold on to dearly to give legitimacy to who we are? For instance, I like hamburgers, and poi is junk, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it makes me think of whatever amendment is that says we have the right to bear arms, how that won our country freedom at one time and now we can't let go of it because it's obviously very valuable to us now.
Yeah. I'm running out of juice on this marker. No, I'm not. Historical precepts or concepts or, yeah, that's good. Anything else you can hold on to in the church? Absolutes that, not absolutes, but things that we, I guess, almost believe are absolutes. One of my favorite stories, it says to me how I try to think theologically and pedagogically or educationally as well, is a story of the man who's walking along the edge of a cliff, and he's just enjoying this beautiful, spectacular day. And above him to his left are mountains, and they're snow-capped, and the clouds are beautiful and white, and it's kind of like Holden Village. And on the right is this very, very steep cliff, and it drops down about 300 feet straight into a valley that's also beautiful. He's looking down, he's looking up, he's looking down. He falls off the cliff, 300 feet straight down. But he's been doing his push-ups and sit-ups and stuff. And there's a branch sticking out, and he grabs a branch on the way down. He had to be pretty strong. Sylvester Stallone, I don't know if he can do that. So there he is hanging on this branch, 150 feet up from the top and 150 feet down from the bottom, and he's in a pickle. Help, help, can anybody help me? He cries. And those puffy white clouds start to rumble together and become a big cloud, and a big voice echoes out of the sky. Yes, I can help you. Who are you? More rumbling, and the clouds stir, and there's all kinds of action in the sky. I am God. What do I have to do? Let go. You heard this? Is there anybody else up there?
Oh,
we all have branches. And the wonderful theological point about that story is, before this guy can come to God, he's got to let go of the most secure thing in his life. As a teacher, I argue that before we can really understand what education is supposed to do, we need to let go of some of those securities that we've long believed in. Specifically, as an English teacher, am I willing to pull Faulkner out of the course, Hemingway out of the course, Melville, name all these classical white American males that have been a part of American literature since we got this whole inception of American literature and developed a canon, and can I slip in Alice Walker, a woman, and a black woman yet, instead of Faulkner? Can you do that? Can you let go? And my argument would be, until we don't really understand what literature is all about, until we're able to do that. Faulkner is not the thing. Literature and its ideas are. And Faulkner is one of those vehicles. So is Alice Walker. Well, Ben Baldwin says, with some pretty explicit and, I think, beautiful language, any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality. We're all out there hanging on to this branch. And we're all out there, English teachers, secure in our knowledge of Hemingway and Faulkner. And I got to mess around with Alice Walker, and I don't know about that. So my own, again, any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it profoundly attacks one's sense of one's own reality. Well, the black man has functioned in the white man's world as a fixed star, as an immovable pillar, and as he moves out of his place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. We white people in power don't like it, do we? Before we go on into this literature, I'd like to have you think of, and this might be hard, and you might not have enough guts to say it, but how has the black man, and we can add woman, again, Baldwin's writing in the early 60s, how can we illustrate that the black man has been an immovable pillar, a fixed star in our world, for those of us who are white? Think of, if you don't want to talk about America, and you know something about South Africa, let's say, pick that. Yeah. How has the black man or woman been a fixed star, an immovable object in our world? And now that he, she's beginning to move, we don't like it. I'll get you started. Oh, go, I don't have to.
Well, no, I was just going to say, for one thing, there used to be these, you know, the black people in this country were an underclass, who could only do certain jobs, and so other jobs were safe for white people.
You can come and be my janitor, and you can be my bellboy and my porter. I don't know if I want you the general of the forces, right? I don't know if I want you flying the airplane and on it goes. Okay, good. Very good. Other things?
We're going through an exercise right now in our corporation I work for, where we're laying off a lot of people. And you have to do it on performance, and then you also have to take into consideration ethnic groups. And in some cases, we're keeping people that aren't as good of performers, whether they be black or deaf or other. That's a very difficult thing to go through. I'm not sure how that specifically equates, but it's very personal to go through that, to sit in a room with a group of people, and then you make this decision based on performance, then you get to a person whose performance is here, and you skip over them because of who they are and what they represent.
Yeah. That's a good point. It's a complex issue, and that really is what we kind of lump under the whole heading of affirmative action kind of stuff, right? And that is a real complex issue. And when, I'll just encourage you to do this, as one thinks about affirmative action, I don't think you could think about that without putting it in an historical context. And then once it's in an historical context, the shape of that, those thoughts are a little bit different. I'm not telling you how to think. Mm-hmm. You know, but maybe the process of how one thinks it is
well, just
helpful.
Because before that sort of system was set up, it was always that blacks were the last hired and the first fired. When it was all on seniority, then since they were the last hired, only in times when they were really needed, you know, then they would finally be hired. And then when the little depression came along, they were also the first fired. So.
Yeah, that's a great point. And then analogies, concrete analogies are, okay, if we supply or implant one kind of priority, that is an affirmative action thing, we've had other priorities going on forever. The boss's son, the boss's daughter, the guy that's been there 25 years but can't teach for diddly, and here comes a young teacher along that's really fired up and ready to go, but he doesn't get the job, or he's the first one laid off, because I see it happen, it has nothing to do with race. So we've already got some criteria set up there, it's just a matter of what criteria we want to use.
We're kind of getting off on a tangent here, but I think this is important to me as an employer. The hiring of people has a lot to do with their cultural conformity. In other words, whether the guy's got black skin or not has less influence than whether he's going to fit in with the group at, from a cultural standpoint, because we don't spend 50% or more of our waking life with people and not interact. So I don't know if that makes any sense to you at all.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. That's the issue in America. I mean, it's one of the major issues in America today. And then those corporations and those educational institutions and those churches, what they argue is we're not that kind of institution. And the bigger the question that haunts below all that is, well, maybe we should be.
That's, well, it's uncomfortable.
Sure. It's we look at the Lutheran Church historically and sociologically, and we are a church of white, Scandinavians and German heritage, and we don't want to bring in a bunch of African drums in our church. We like the music we've got. Okay, that's okay. I mean, that's an argument that concretely that illustrates what you're saying. And then what's your responsibility? I don't know. I'm not here to preach that. I'm here to kind of illustrate to us what the complex dimensions of that kind of thinking become. And then we wrestle with those ourselves.
It seems to me, in this light, one of the things that we hang on to is that sameness. And the comfortableness that goes along with being the same is good. Whereas what I'm beginning to discover in my life is that I learn so much from other people that are different.
Yeah.
So sameness has been a value. Now maybe we can shift to where diversity is a value.
It's good. Sameness is, like it or not, we're just talking about it. That's one of those branches that we hold on to. We'll try not to for this hour. You can go out and do that on your own. Make value judgments about that. Let's just make the observations. Sameness is one of the things we hold on to. Yeah, Rob.
To quote a fast food chain, Arby's is different. Arby's different is good. There's a big sign up in that, which always throws me, you know, coming from Arby's.
Just, that's good. That's a great illustration. Well, here's Baldwin. Baldwin is a... what I would call is a true to the Gospels Christian. He's very much against the institutionalized church as he's talking about the black church, as he has seen it, Christianity manifest in his life, full of other absolutes as well. And here's how he talks about some of those branches that we hold on to. The universe, which is not merely the stars and the moon and the planets, flowers, grass, and trees, but also other, he's got that italicized, other people, has evolved no terms for your existence, he's writing to his black, of course, nephew, has made no room for you, because we value sameness. And it's not comfortable flying, I'm thinking of the Hells Angels, not the Hells Angels, that's the worst second group. The Blue Angels, and they've got their black pilot, you know, up there, and the white guys beside them, you know, and they're going 600 miles an hour, and they're 6 inches apart, and it's not comfortable. I mean, it was an issue to get a black pilot in there, okay, and Bill, you can maybe talk about, maybe you can't, but you're a pilot and you can sense, feel that, wow, I'm going pretty fast here and I gotta trust these guys very much. Has made no room for you. And here's Baldwin and here's Christianity. But if love will not swing wide the gates, no other power will or can. And if one despairs, and who is not, of human love, God's love alone is left. But God, and I felt this even then long ago on that tremulous floor, he's talking about his experience of conversion, but God is white. So, even God has been set up as a certain kind of absolute, and even that absolute, it presents itself as this is the way things will be. And now we look at our Lutheran church and discover the absolutes that we've set up for God and for how we respond to that. And I want to run by it again. The universe, which is not merely the stars, the moon, and the planets, the flowers, and the grass, and trees, but other people, has evolved no terms for you, the black man, or if we were at the forum last night, Native Americans, or we got all kinds of marginalized people, has evolved no terms for your existence, has made no room for you. And if love cannot swing wide the gates, no other power will or can. And that's the only, or at least it's the major message that comes out of the New Testament again and again and again. Well, so how do we know? And he says, well, God is white. And then, so, well, then how do you even discern what God is or what he's supposed to do? He has an answer for that. And then we'll go to the literature. If the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only be to make us larger, freer, and more loving. In that context, these absolutes, think about them now, with Baldwin's idea of God, is larger, freer, how do you spell freer, right? And more loving. And then think of all that we know as church people and how we, and if not, if that's an indeed a legitimate New Testament criteria for God, and I'd encourage you to read, again, any book in of the Gospels anyway and see if that isn't really what Jesus is about. Larger, freer, and more loving, when in fact most of the things that we do and most of the things that we do institutionally, I'm thinking now of educational institutions, make us smaller. No, don't worry about Alice Walker, stick to him anyway. Less free and considerably less loving. Here's how that's illustrated in one of the wonderful novels of the 20th century, Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon. My favorite character in literature, in American literature, is the main character in this book. Her name is Pilot Dead. And she got her name because her father, just put his finger down, he couldn't see, just put his finger down in the Bible and pointed to a name and said, that's my daughter's name. And they said, you can't name your daughter that. He killed Christ. Where'd my finger land? It landed on Pilate. Then that's her name. Well, she's got this name. And Pilate also is born, this is fiction, with no navel. And so she's got this smooth belly that people look at and ostracize her. And so throughout this book, this woman is ostracized. And we laugh at that. And that's an appropriate response. And I'm sure that's what Toni Morrison is after. You ostracize somebody because they have no navel? And then the bigger question is, look at the other reasons we ostracize people. I mean, they are just as silly as that. Well, here's the kind of character that Pilate is. This person who cannot be a part of any group because they don't want her. Her nephew, whose name is Milkman, or also Macon Dead, has been told by his father, her brother, stay away from her. She's a witch, she's evil, she's no good, she's dirty, she's a drunk. Don't go near her. Well, just like my kids, oh, is that right? I gotta find out who that is. So they want to go near her. So after, when Milkman is about 13 or 14, he finally comes to see his aunt. They found her on the front step, sitting wide-legged in a long-sleeved, long-skirted black dress. Her hair was wrapped in black, too, and from a distance, All they could really see beneath her face was the bright orange she was peeling. She was all angles, he remembered later, knees mostly, and elbows, 1 foot pointed east and 1 foot pointed west. As they came closer and saw the brass box dangling from her ear, Milkman knew that what with the earring, the orange, and the angled black cloth, nothing, not the wisdom of his father nor the caution of the world, could keep him from her. Guitar, that's this Milkman's friend, being older and already in high school, had none of the reluctance that his young buddy still struggled with and was the first one to speak. "Hi!" The woman looked up, first at Guitar and then at Milkman. "What kind of a word is that?" Her voice was light but gravel sprinkled. Milkman kept on staring at her fingers, manipulating the orange. Guitar grinned and shrugged. "Well, it means hello." "Well, then say what you mean." "Okay, hello. That's better. What you want?" "Nothing. We just passing by." "Look like you standing by to me." "If you don't want us here, Miss Pilot, we'll go." "I ain't the one with the wants. You're the one who wants something." "We want to ask you something." Guitar stopped, feigning indifference. She was too direct for him, and to keep up with her, he had to pay careful attention to his language. "Ask it." "Somebody said you ain't got no navel. That the question?" "Yes." "Don't sound like a question, sound like an answer. Give me the question." "Do you?" "Do I what?" "Do you have a navel?" "No." "What happened to it?" "Beats me." "Now, do I get to ask a question?" "Sure. Who's your little friend?" "This here's Milkman." "Do he talk?" Pilot swallowed a piece of the fruit. "Yeah, he talk. Say something." Guitar shoved an elbow at Milkman without taking his eyes off Pilot. Milkman took a breath, held it, and said, "Hi." Pilot laughed. "You all must be the dumbest Negroes on earth. What they telling you in them schools? You say hi to pigs and sheep when you want them to move. When you tell a human being hi, he ought to get up and knock you down." Shame had flooded him. He had expected to feel it, but not this kind. To be embarrassed, yes, but not that way. She was the one who was ugly, dirty, poor, and drunk. The queer aunt whom his sixth grade schoolmates teased him about and whom he hated because he felt personally responsible for her ugliness, her poverty, her dirt, and her wine. Instead, she was making fun of his school, of his teachers, of him. And while she looked as poor as everyone said she was, something was missing from her eyes that should have confirmed it. Nor was she dirty. Unkempt, yes, but not dirty. The whites of her fingernails were like ivory. And unless he knew absolutely nothing, this woman was definitely not drunk. Of course, she was anything but pretty. Yet he knew he could have watched her all day. The fingers pulling thread veins from the orange sections, the berry black lips that made her look as though she wore makeup, the earring. And when she stood up, he all but gasped. She was as tall as his father, head and shoulders taller than himself. Her dress wasn't as long as he had thought. It came to just below her calf, and now he could see her unlaced men's shoes and the silvery brown skin of her ankles. That's Pilot. That's an introduction to her. Now I want to compare with you. This is all about love and freedom. The reason you don't go see Pilot, says Milkman's father, again, who is Pilot's sister, and he grew up with her, and she's crazy, he thinks. She's crazy because she's got this kind of crazy sense of values. Here are the values you should have. Boy, you got better things to do with your time than hang around her besides the time you started learning how to work. You start Monday. One of the branches we have up here is work. One of my favorite pieces of literature comes from Smahala Speaks, the prophet of the Nez Perce Indians, and he says, "My men shall never work." Now, all of us, men. Whoa, I mean, that's part of the macho identity. "My men shall never work, for men who work cannot dream, and wisdom lies in dreams." Like it or not, when nobody's asking you to agree with that, it's a whole nother branch. It's a whole nother, another kind of philosophy to live by. And that hard work isn't what makes you a man. By the way, the women did all the hard work in that society. But that's kind of another point, and we could talk about that too. But the whole philosophy to live by that is that this isn't what gives you your identity, your work, and your the kind of macho connections that we make for that. "My men shall never work, for men who work cannot dream." Well, Macon dead, Pilot's brother, Milkman's father, he's into the mainstream. You start to learn how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office, work a couple of hours there, and learn what's real. Pilot can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. Let me tell you right now, the one important thing you'll ever need to know, own things. And let the things you own other things. Then you'll own yourself and other people too. Starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how. Got it. And that's a branch. That's one of those chimeras. I'll read that in a second. Those kind of crazy beasts that we hang on to for security, and they destroy us every time. And remember that little story. Anybody else up there? Our reluctance to come to God, or take it out of that theological context and put it in the philosophical one, our reluctance to come to truth. We went to this branch. And it's not going to be a very nice existence, is it, for that guy the rest of his life? I mean, it's 150 feet. I mean, who's going to feed him? Roll it down. But I'd rather hang on to that branch than take the risk of letting go. Well, Pilate, ostracized, as you've already heard, has a little different philosophy. And the narrative says this about Pilate. After having been ostracized from so many people, you don't see this specifically spelled out, but she's had a making love session with a guy that she loves. Pilate does have a daughter, and it's from that one union. And he apparently gets up, and we don't know anything about it, except that he says this to her, "My God, what are you, some kind of mermaid?" And he runs away. And that it's important because the narrator now is going to say how she is denied intimate relationships. And she's also a part of a community where she's the leader and she's the worker, and it's on an island off the coast of the southern United States. And she keeps this no-navel thing pretty much hidden. And then somebody finds out about it, and they kick her out of the community. All because she has no navel. Finally, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned, and began at zero. The branch, throw it away. Every assumption she had and began at zero. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad? And what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What is true in the world? Throughout this fresh, if common, pursuit of knowledge, one conviction crowned her efforts. Since death held no terrors for her, she spoke often to the dead. And that's true in this novel, and she does, and it's kind of a neat thing. She knew there was nothing to fear. And true to the palm oil that flowed in her veins, she never had a visitor to whom she did not offer food before one word of conversation, business, or social began. She tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy? When am I sad? And what is the difference? Toni Morrison's message, if we want to make this a moralistic kind of novel, is how many of us even ask that question? When am I happy? When am I sad? Am I happiest when I've got some things around me? I've got my water skis and my boat and my car and my and on. Well, this novel ends. Pilate dies. She gets shot. And she's shot in the arms of her nephew, Milkman. She stood up then, and it seemed to Milkman that he had heard the shot after she fell. He dropped to his knees and cradled her lolling head in the crook of his arm, barking at her, "You hurt? You hurt, Pilate?" She laughed softly, and he knew right away that she was reminded of the day he first met her and said the most stupid thing there was to say. The twilight had thickened, and all around them it was getting dark. Milkman moved his hand over her chest and stomach, trying to find a place where she might be hit. "Pilate, you okay?" He couldn't make out her eyes. His hand under her head was sweating like a fountain. "Pilate!" She sighed. "Watch Reba for me." That's her daughter. "And then, I wished I'd have known more people. I would have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more." It's the end of her book. The branch for Pilate has been deliberately, almost calculatingly arrived at through a thoughtful process that was, although, or that was forced upon her by her own ostracization from society and from intimate relations. So she has to ask the tough questions. Most of us don't have to ask those. And we will go on with our own historical, my image for me is that there's this big snowball going down the mountain. And wherever it goes, we're just going to get on. We don't stop to see what it's going to run over. That's just it. And it's not even something that we deliberately think about. We just hop on. We don't think deliberately as a church, I don't think. We've got this black pastor and we've got this mission in the streets and geez, let's not fund that. Nobody says that. But the snowball ain't going that way. And we don't stop it. Or we don't change its course. We just let it build. That's institutional racism. It isn't something that we need to feel guilty about, white folks. It's something we need to do something about. And that is, take action and check that snowball and see where it might go. Well, this wonderful book, The Color Purple by Alice Walker, is full of very unconventional relationships. Homosexual relationships, families that are raised with two fathers and two women in the same house, and it's kind of all changed. And I remember when this book first came out, and I'd heard it was good, and I was going to read it to see if I should teach it in my African-American literature class, and I had it on my desk at home, and my mother-in-law from Rockford, Illinois, the mecca of liberalism, the 75-year-old woman, you laughed, and that was right, saw this book, and she said, "Oh, I've heard about that, can I read it?" And I go, I got to explain to my mother-in-law why I might be teaching this book. And, I mean, the language is rough, the scene, a lot of those sexual scenes. And I didn't know what to say, so I said, "Yeah, go ahead." So, a couple days later, I got up the gumption to say, "How do you like the book?" That's as much gumption I had right there. She says, "Oh, it's good." And then my next question was what? "Well, how far are you?" "You mean page two or what?" I just finished it. And one of the great things that Alice Walker has achieved in this book is the ability to make us suspend our judgment about conventional relationships. We don't. And if my mother-in-law didn't judge, ain't nobody gonna. Okay. And somehow, the power of love to transcend what in this book is normally then seen as conventional relationships, it just consumes all those relationships, or transcends them all, I guess is a better word. And love is the thing. And listen then to these characters talk about trying to get a hold of them, trying to get released into freedom so that they can and indeed love with a sense of truth and reality and sincerity. The book opens, and it's a collection of, and this is in the bookstore and in the library as well, and I would encourage you to read it. The book is a series of letters. Most of them are written to God. And the very first page is, "Dear God, I am 14 years old. I have always been a good girl. Maybe you can give me a sign letting me know what is happening to me." And that's the plea from the beginning. "I'm 14, and dear God, what's happening to me?" And there are a lot of things then throughout this book that are going to happen to this girl. Right now she's pregnant, and she doesn't understand how she got pregnant because she's ignorant about just the biology of that. But it's much more than that. "And dear God, can you tell me, I've been a good girl, let me know what's happened to me." And then she watches her mother die, she watches her favorite sister get shipped off to Africa, and on with kind of some pretty tragic things. And she meets a woman who brings her up out of, this on one level, psychological, this low self-esteem, and then into another kind of spiritual level of a sense of important self in God's kingdom. And this woman talks, one woman is named Shug, after sugar, and Seeley is the main character in the book. And Seeley has given up on God. The first letter was, "Dear God, tell me what's happened to me." Later on, she just stops writing to God because she doesn't get very satisfactory answers. And "I don't write to God no more. I write to you, Nettie, my sister. "What happened to God?" asked Shug. "Who that?" I say. She looked at me serious. "Big a devil as you," I say. "You're not worried about no God, surely." Shug is a pretty wild lifestyle, and we see in this novel. And Shug say, "Wait a minute. Hold on just a minute here. Just because I don't harass, it seemed like, I don't harass it like some people's us know, don't mean I ain't got religion." "What God ever do for me?" I asked. She say, "See me," like she's shocked. "He gave you life, good health, and a good woman that love you to death." And that's just a momentarily, it's a homosexual relationship. But it moves way out of that as the novel goes on. And that relation, the sex part of it isn't even there anymore. So that's an important thing, I think, for those of us who have any kind of phobia about that. "And a good woman that love you to death." "Yeah," I say. "And he give me a lynch daddy, a crazy mama, a low-down dog of a step-pa, and a sister I probably won't ever see again. Anyhow, I say, the God I've been praying and writing to is a man. And act just like all the other men I know. Trifling, forgetful, and low down." She say, "Miss Seeley, you better hush. God might hear you." "Let him hear me. If he ever listened to the poor colored woman, the world might be a different place, I can tell you." She talk and she talk, trying to budge me away from my blasphemy, but I blaspheme much as I want to. "All my life," said Shug, "I never care what people thought about nothing I did. But deep in my heart, I care about God. What he going to think? And come to find out, he don't think. Just sit up there glorifying and being deaf." I'm sorry, this is not Shug. This is Seeley who's saying this about God. "Just sit up there glorifying and being deaf, I reckon. But it ain't easy trying to do without God. Even if you know he ain't there, trying to do without him is a strain." Shug says, then I'm a sinner because I was born. I don't deny that. But once you find out what's out there waiting for us, what else can you be? Sinners have more good times, I say. "You know why?" she asked. "Because you ain't all the time worrying about God," I say. "No, that ain't it. Us worry about God a lot. But once us feel loved by God, us do the best us can to please him with what we like. You telling me God love you and you don't never done nothing for him? I mean, here are some more branches. I mean, not go to church, sing in the choir, feed the preacher, and all that stuff. But if God loved me, Seeley, I don't have to do all that. Unless I want to. There's a lot of other things I can do that I expect God likes." "Like what?" "Oh, I can lay back and admire stuff. Creation, be happy." This sounds like blasphemy to me. "Seeley, tell the truth. Have you ever..." Listen to this, and think of those branches. "Have you ever found God in church?" "I never did. I just found a whole bunch of people..." Sorry, I don't have my glasses on. I'm going to start that again because it's a good paragraph. "Seeley, tell the truth. Have you ever found God in church?" "I never did. I just found a bunch of folks hoping for him to show." "Any God I ever felt in church, I brought in with me. And I think all the other folks did too. They come to church to share God, not find God." "Some folks didn't have them to share," I said. They're the ones that didn't speak to me while I was there struggling with my big belly and Mr. Albert's children." "Right," she said. "Tell me what your God looked like, Seeley." "Now, I'm too ashamed. Nobody ever asked me this before, so I'm sort of took by surprise. Besides, when I think about it, it don't seem quite right. But it's all I got. I decided to stick up for God just to see what Shug say. Okay, I say, he's big and old and tall and gray-bearded and white. He wear white robes and go barefooted. Blue eyes?" she asked. "Sort of blue. Cool, big though. White lashes," I say. She laugh. "Why you laugh?" I asked. "I don't think it's so funny. What you expect him to look like? Mr. Albert?" That's her husband. "That wouldn't be no improvement," she say. "Then she told me this old white man is the same God she used to see when she prayed. If you wait to find God in church, Seeley," she say, "that's who was bound to show up, because that's where he lived." "How come?" I asked. "Because that's the one that's in the white folks' white Bible." "Shug," I say. "God wrote the Bible. White folks had nothing to do with it." "Well, how come he looked just like them then?" she say, "only bigger, and a heap more hair. How come the Bible, just like everything else they make, all about them doing one thing and another, and all the colored folks doing is getting cursed?" "I never thought about that." I'm skipping. "Here's the thing," say Shug. "The thing I believe. God is inside you, and inside everybody else." What does Jesus say about that? "The kingdom of God is within." And most of us, the theological perspective that gives us these branches is that the kingdom of God is someplace without, and it's something we... The thing I believe, God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it find it inside. And sometimes it is God now. It just manifests itself even if you're not looking or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble doing for most folks, I think. Sorrow. Feeling like shit. It, I asked. Yeah, it. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. But what do it look like? Don't look like nothing. It ain't a picture show. It ain't something you can look at apart from anything else, including yourself. I believe God is everything. We can get on to this, and you can discuss it if you want to. I don't think it's the point of the book, that this is some kind of New Age picture of God. It's really a picture, I think, that's one way to one context to put it in. But another one is, I would ask you to put it in the context of the Gospels, God. And so God is everything. She talks about sex a little bit, and Shug says, God made sex. Listen, God loved everything you love, and a mess of stuff that you don't. But more than anything else, God loved admiration. You saying God vain? No, not vain. Just wanting to share good things. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. What'd it do when it pissed off, I asked. Oh, it makes something else. People think pleasing God is all God care about. But any living fool in the world can see it's always trying to please us back. Well, us talk and talk about God, but I'm still adrift, trying to chase that old white man out of my head. I've been so busy thinking about him, I never truly noticed nothing God make. Not a blade of corn. How do it do that? Not the color purple. Where's that come from? Not the little wildflowers. Nothing. Man corrupt everything, says Shug. These are those branches. Listen. He's on your box of grits, in your head, and all over the radio. He try to make you think he everywhere. As soon as you think he everywhere, you think he's God. But he ain't. Whenever you try to pray and man plop himself on the other end of it, tell him to get lost, say Shug. Conjure up flowers, wind, water, a big rock, and love. That's the end of her explanation. Man corrupts, and I don't think this is a treatise on male bashing. Man is males, but man is society. Man corrupt everything. He's on your box of grits, right? When I was a little kid, my box of grits was Wheaties, and I wanted to look just like that athlete, right? And if I didn't look like that athlete, I didn't feel quite as good about myself as I thought I could have. He's in your head. He's all over the radio. Add to that TV. This is set in the 40s. He try to make you think he everywhere. As soon as you think he everywhere, you think he's God. Is there anybody else up there? Life is tragic. Simply because the earth turns and the sun inexorably rises and sets, and one day, for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives. We'll imprison ourselves in totems, taboos, crosses, blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations, in order to deny the fact of death, which is the only fact we have, except that one is responsible to life. It is the small beacon in that terrifying darkness from which we come and to which we shall return. One clings to chimeras. That's an old Greek monster that's got a head of one creature, the tail of another, and it's an incongruous putting together of things. Anyway, one clings then to chimeras by which one can only be betrayed, and the entire hope, the entire possibility of freedom, disappears. So we got branches, and now with Baldwin's language, we got chimeras. You fire away for a while. What are some of the things that we hang on to? And the results are that we're blinded by those historical forces that don't let us reach out, well, you know, for Baldwin, and for Walker and for Morrison too. And I believe for every black writer, and I would expand that to every poet, writer that I know, white or black, that freedom and love are connected and the only way to get here. And if you think that's a radical idea, then go back to William Blake and Wordsworth and Keats and the guys that, you know, are not radical as we see them. So what are some of those chimeras that we hang on to? We started with them. Any more? Yeah.
I think in the church especially, we hang on to God the Father, and we hang on to an image of Jesus that's male and European and all that sort of thing. And anything new that comes up, we sort of bash it and we hold it up against, you know, this blueprint God, and it never adds up. So we, you know, we spend a lot of time tossing it out, and we lose a lot of the richness that people can bring. You know, we don't incorporate enough of humanity.
If we let go of these, just these two, what might we find? I'm not asking you to do that. I'm just saying now we've got to lose our imagination. Literature expresses that too. What might we find?
Might be female.
Might be. Now, let's just ask your question. All of a sudden, we've stopped thinking, we've held on to this branch, we've got this one chimera that we hold on to, and we let go of that. If we found that out, is that all bad? Okay, European. I grew up in a family that was very, very musical, and my dad and all his brothers and sisters played the piano or the violin and sang, and I just grew up with that stuff, and I loved it, and I still do love classical music. And that was the thing, this is really the best, boy, I really like this. And I have about 9 tapes of South African music that has just sent me away. I haven't stopped liking this. And someone who says, maybe, you know, it's the branches, you get the point, I guess. So European, I use music or concepts of God, but European music is cool. But if I let go of that only, what else might I bring? And then the same question, is that all bad? Keep going. And if you can, think of these things in 2 places, just for our focus, because we've got about 3 minutes. In the church and or in our racial conflicts.
I'm finding it hard to articulate this, but the sense of being in control and having power over my life. I mean, that's what's frightening about letting go. I hate the image of God as Father, frankly. I'm struggling with it for years, but it's really hard to let go of. Not that I'm afraid of God being female. Perhaps I'm afraid of God not being there. I let go of what I know that maybe God isn't
that's
there.
That's articulated fear for lots of us.
And that's true in personal, and then to just take it out of the realm of that, but to bring it smaller, just dealing with my parents or friends or family, dealing with myself and my own idiosyncrasies, somehow trying to control my life, I think. And for me, that hits all the other things, too, history and the underclass and keeping people in a certain social strata. It's so that those on top can stay on top and retain that control. So control is, I think, the biggest branch or the trunk of the tree.
I thought of a concrete image as you're talking about that. I used to be a pilot, and when I learned how, I can remember flying my instructor right over here, and I got in, all of a sudden we hit the clouds, and I was definitely in a situation I didn't want to be in. And I said, Gus, it's yours. I could have kept in control, and then go back to the same question, is it all bad that I give the control to Gus? I am alive today because I did. And so we don't know what we might find. And that's a great example, and probably one of the profound roots of how we are to do this.
Part of that control, I think, is that we need to be able, in our language, to describe what God is, what He is. I mean, we can't. We are directly.
Yeah. And the Old Testament says you can't do it, doesn't it? You know, there'd be no name. And how many people got a little uneasy about it?
Yeah.
We don't like that, do we? Come on. And because it's not the language that we're used to. It. In, what?
Yeah.
Well, you're kind of a
radical. Yeah, I don't have my name button on. Okay. I was going to mention jobs.
Work.
We think, I know a lot of people, particularly in the nursing profession and teaching, that stay in these jobs and never leave and never move on to doing anything else.
Especially work.
Yeah. We're pretty happy where we are. I'm sorry.
43 years ago, as a freshman in college, I had attended a NAACP meeting, and my very conservative grandfather saw some literature I had. Well, it's okay to be a friend with them, maybe in college, but don't you ever marry one. Now that, of course, goes to many, many races.
Yeah.
It not only went to Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but it went to other religions as well.
Yeah.
So life itself, these things that so many of us hang on to because of our conservative grandfathers.
In black literature, the images that are there, I mean, I'm generalizing now, the place where whites and blacks intermarry and get along the best, and there are no problems, are among the whom? The poor. Where the sham of society is not as big an issue because they don't participate in it anyway.
I've said this before, but I have my family at home cannot understand for the life of them how I can stay up here at Holden with all these white people. And that becomes a branch to that door to them, and just the, you know, just the pain and the stuff you hear about whites growing up. And then to then let go of that and go out amongst whites is very scary. And friends and relatives simply don't understand. And it just doesn't, it simply doesn't make sense why you would want to go and then live with the enemy. And so that's kind of a struggle in my life and for a lot of African Americans I know who have done that, primarily those I've met in seminary and everything, is that big struggle.
Yeah. Wow. Anybody else? Well, you can think about your branches, and I think about my branches every day. And I want to tell you, as a teacher of this stuff, I have no one-upmanship on any of you. I got just as many branches that I'm struggling with too. And you just got to know that. So.